Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Gift of Grace on the Word 1220. This is Phil Giuliotti here on another awesome Sunday night. And this is the Gift of Grace, where we read and teach God's Word, and we proclaim the kingdom and salvation in Jesus the Messiah. So I hope you all had an awesome week. Today we're going to do a teaching about a question that Jesus asks his closest disciples, the apostles themselves. And we're going to go to Matthew 16. We're going to do verses 13 to 19 if you want to flip to it or click on it or whatever you have to do. Matthew 16, 13 to 19. So he asks them a question. Now, before we get to the question, we have to give kind of the background on this, the context of this. This happens in the far north of the land. Actually, it's at the very northern limit of the land of Canaan, the land of Israel at the time. And it is, if you go to this area today, it is right at the Israeli-Lebanese border and also very close to the Syrian border. My wife and I have been to this place and driven by this place a few times. It's beautiful scenery with mountains and streams and the river. The Jordan River starts nearby there, and the mountains with Mount Hermon in the background. And it's really quite a beautiful area. And what's not usually talked about in the passage that we're going to discuss is the fact that Jesus takes his apostles up to this place, and it's basically in a pagan land. In fact, this whole passage takes place at a shrine which was built to honor the Greek god Pan, P-A-N. And there's a mountain with a beautiful waterfall there. And in ancient times, there was a shrine there. So a pagan shrine that he takes them all the way up to see. Now, if you start in Capernaum, which is presumably where he was headquartered at the time, but in that general area, which, of course, is where most of his teachings and most of his miracles took place. So let's say they left from Capernaum, which is reasonable since Peter's house was there and so forth. If you go by car, there's really two highways you have to take to get to this site. In modern-day Israel, this area is called Banias. I don't remember why, but you have to go up one highway going north. Then you have to head east on another highway. And from Capernaum, it's probably about 45 minutes to an hour drive. Probably an hour drive. Now, on foot, an hour drive, which might be 50 to 60 miles by car. Well, these aren't big highways, but let's say even if it's 40 miles by car, by foot, walking at 3 miles an hour, you can see that it's going to take you about 13 or 14 hours to get to this place. And then, of course, you have to stop and rest, so that it was probably at least a two-day journey by foot. Maybe 3 days, who knows? But anyway, so he went all the way up there to sit in front of a pagan shrine with his closest disciples, and he asks them a question. Now, this area was called, one last piece of background. I know the time will go by before you know it. But one last piece of background. This area is called Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea, obviously, was in honor of Caesar. There was another Caesarea, which is Caesarea Maritima, which is a beautiful spot on the Mediterranean coast, which was the main Roman port, and was actually where the governor lived. And Rome kind of ran things from Caesarea Maritima, and it was the main embarkation point to go to the rest of the Mediterranean world. And we know that Paul left from there and so forth. And it was, Romans hated being in Jerusalem. If you were a Roman official, you hated being in Jerusalem. Soldiers hated being in Jerusalem. The governor hated to be in Jerusalem when he had a nice place in Caesarea Maritima overlooking the Mediterranean. It was much nicer. So this is Caesarea Philippi. So Caesarea, named after Caesar. Philippi was named after Philip the Tetrarch, who was one of these, I don't know, kind of puppet kings that ruled the area. And I don't want to go down a whole rabbit trail on that. But he named it the Caesarea of himself, basically. And so this was this whole area that was, as I say, on the boundary or just into pagan Gentile territory. So let's go to Matthew 16, 13 and on. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" So they said, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And also I say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." So, he asks a question, and it's interesting to see he refers to himself as the Son of Man. He doesn't say, "Who do people say that I, the Son of God, am?" And he doesn't say, "What do people think of the fact that I came from heaven, I was incarnated, and now I'm here talking to you?" He said, calls himself the Son of Man, which he very, very commonly did. It was one of the most common ways that he referred to himself. As you know, as you read through the Gospels, you see this over and over again. And so he's the Son of Man. He's born of a woman. He's born of Mary. Paul points out in Galatians, he's born of a woman, born under the law. So he was born of a woman, just like everybody else who was listening to him, and just like everybody else in history has, other than Adam and Eve. Other than Adam and Eve, every single human being who's ever lived was born of a woman. So he's born of Mary, who, of course, is a real human woman. He has 100% human nature. He's 100% man and 100% God in the same person, in the same being. Well, I guess we can say person in this case, in the same person. There's no mixture or confusion of the natures. He has both natures. And, of course, he also has real heredity. And you can trace the heredity, and Matthew writes it all out for us. Luke writes it all out for us. The real heredity. And we know that he's descended, well, of course, from Adam and Eve, as Luke points out. Luke takes it all the way back to Adam. So, of course, he's related to Adam and Eve in his physical body, which means he is related to us in the term that he, in the sense that he is our brother. And so he's, in the book of Hebrews, the writer says he's not ashamed to call us brethren. He's not ashamed to call us brethren. Even though the way we live our lives and the way we act and the way we think and the way we behave in almost every situation, he should be ashamed to call us brethren, But the writer to the Hebrews says he's not ashamed to call us brethren. So he has real heredity from the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It's very important that you understand, in the Tanakh, the Old Testament, God always identifies himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So many of the prayers in the synagogue refer to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he is physically, in his humanity, descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob's son, Judah. Jesus Yeshua is physically descended from Jacob's son, Judah. He is therefore in the tribe of Judah. He actually has a humanity that is linked to a lineage of people and part of a tribe of the Israelites, the tribe of Judah, which hopefully you do some study of Torah. If you don't, and 99% of believers do not, so you're certainly not alone. But if you do any study of Torah, you see how the heredity unfolds, what the importance of the tribe is. And if you go back to Genesis 49, when Jacob is about to die, and he does a blessing over his sons, and Joseph's two sons, who are his grandsons, Manasseh and Ephraim, when he does the blessing over them, when he blesses Judah, who, if you remember, was kind of pretty much of a creep. He wanted to kill his brother Joseph, threw him in the pit, took him out of the pit, sold him to the Midianites as a slave. He said, we might as well make some, we don't want to kill, okay, if we don't want to kill him because he's our brother, we should at least get some money out of this. So they sold him to the Midianites, and he, of course, ended up in Egypt. So this was Judah, who was the ancestor of Messiah. And we won't get into all the sordid details. There's some pretty unsavory characters in his lineage and some wonderful people in his lineage. But then it goes down to King David, and Messiah, of course, as you know, is the son of David. So he has this real humanity. Mary and Joseph are both from the line of David, Dr. Luke tells us. So he uses the term son of man. He is, in fact, the son of God, and he had emptied himself to be a servant. He had come only to be a sacrifice, did not come to be a philosopher, did not come to be a teacher, although he taught incredibly well. He told us how we should live our lives, but he could have done that without dying. He came because he had to die, and he had to bleed in order to cover sin. So he had emptied himself. So instead of using his high title, he uses his low title. He doesn't call himself the Son of God. He calls himself the Son of Man. This is mentioned in Daniel 7:13. We're not going to go into all this. This is the fulfillment of Daniel talking about one like the Son of Man who's presented before the Ancient of Days, who, of course, is God, the Father. And you can read Daniel chapter 7. And this is why when he calls himself Son of Man, when he's with the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they get upset because they know immediately that he is saying he is this man called the Son of Man that Daniel talks about in chapter 7. And this infuriates them. This is blasphemous to them. And so he uses his lower title and he asks them a question. Two questions. First question is, who do the common people think that I am? You know, the way this is phrased, he doesn't say, well, what do all those smart guys in Jerusalem think? What do the Pharisees and the scribes, you know, all those high power guys. What's the chief priest think about this? What's the high priest think about this? No, he says, what do the people, the word actually means the crowd. What does the crowd think? Who do people say that I am? Not who do the leaders say I am. The Pharisees, the religious leaders despised common people, just despised them. They didn't follow the law. They weren't good. They weren't educated. They were on and on and on. And you know all that. In fact, they called them people of the land, which was a derogatory term, not a compliment. So the people that he's talking about were the people in the crowds, the ordinary people, the common people. These people had seen a lot of miracles. They had heard teachings. Now, the Pharisees had heard teachings. The Pharisees had seen miracles. But they weren't open to this. They weren't open to him or to the work he was doing. Not open. So the disciples answer when he says, well, who do the crowds say that I am? Well, a few options. You know, some people, say you're John the Baptist. Some people say you're one of the prophets. You know, some people say you're Elijah come back. Some people say you're Jeremiah come back. They mention all these people who were dead. Everybody that they mentioned was dead. Now, they had some vague idea about the afterlife. In fact, in modern Judaism, the ideas of the afterlife are not really, really well developed, because the general feeling is that when Messiah comes, he'll give us all the details about the afterlife, which, of course, he did. But since they didn't, the vast, vast majority did not recognize him as Messiah and do not recognize him as Messiah, at least for today. That may change any day or week or month now as his coming comes closer, because we know all Israel will be saved. So there was some idea of resurrection after death. There was some idea about an afterlife. They knew about the ideas of the prophets. They were familiar with the prophets as special, commonly called oracles. They were filled with the Spirit. They said, thus says the Lord, and gave the people instructions, or sometimes reprimanded the people. And the people had great respect for them. So they mention all these dead people. People say, you're one of those people. He doesn't answer that. He goes on to question number two. But who do you say I am? Now he's talking to the apostles. He's talking to his closest students, his closest disciples, his closest friends. We have to keep this concept of friend in mind, too. We'll maybe do a show about that someday. He calls us friends. We're his brother and we're his friend, or sister and his friend. So he says, well, who do you say I am? They knew him so much better than everybody else did. All these people who said, he's Jeremiah, he's Elijah, he's John the Baptist, I don't know. He's some prophet. Maybe he's the prophet from Deuteronomy 18, like they asked John. They learned from him. They were called in a very special way. And, of course, they were going to be sent. They were going to be commissioned. And, of course, who do you say I am? It's not just a question for them. It's a question for every single person who has ever lived since that day. It's a question for people living in 21st century world, no matter where you live. The question is, who do you say that he is? Because your whole eternal destiny depends on that. Your eternal destiny does not depend on, well, I like some of his ideas and some of them I don't like, and oh, it's really good he came to teach us how to live, and it's really nice, we're supposed to love everybody, and maybe we could even like everybody best we can do, but, you know, we're going to try to live a better life, and those are important things. But if that's all you think of him, your eternal destiny is in serious jeopardy. So this is a question for everyone. So Peter, who usually, as I like to say, is not afraid to shoot off his mouth about whatever anybody's talking about, this time gives a terrific answer, which is very commonly called the Great Confession. He answers the question, and the rest of them seem to concur with this, because it doesn't say that anybody else said anything, or nobody said, wait a minute. What? What'd you say? No. So they seem to agree. It's very short. It's very powerful. This is the heart of Christianity. And that is, of course, that Peter says, you are the Christ. Okay? We use the word Christ from Christos. He could have said, you are the Messiah. He would have said, you are the Messiah. Peter would have used the term Mashiach. Both Christos and Mashiach mean the anointed one. So he says, you are the Christ, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Short, powerful confession, short, powerful statement of faith, very powerful, done in front of all the rest of the people, said directly to Jesus himself, which shows that not only is this the heart of Christianity, but this shows total devotion that he has to Jesus, total devotion to him and his true nature. Knows exactly who he is. You are the Christ. You're the Son of God. And this is said in the setting of a pagan shrine. They're sitting in front of a shrine to the god Pan. And Peter makes this beautiful confession and calls him the living God, which, as you look through the Old Testament, the Tanakh, and also many times in the New Testament, the Brit Hadashah, you see the term the living God. I swear by the living God, this by the living God. And the living God was a very common term in Hebrew, which basically referred to the fact that God has all life in himself. He is completely self-sufficient. He's El Shaddai. He doesn't rely on anything for his existence. He doesn't rely on anyone for his existence. He is completely alive and sufficient in himself. He has no need to create people. He has no need for us to do something for him. He wants us to. He tells us what he wants us to do. If you haven't heard him telling, you haven't been telling you, you haven't been listening, but that's another subject. He has life in himself. This is the concept of El Shaddai, one of the most powerful names of God. I should say titles of God, attributes of God. God only has one name. So you can think about what his real name, capital N, is. Hashem, the name. He only has one name. But all the names that are attributed to him are actually attributes and titles. So he is El Shaddai. They mentioned all these other dead men, but now Peter says you're the Son of the living God, which means you have the same nature as God. He says you're the Christ, you're the anointed one. You're the one that the entire Old Testament talks about. You're the one going back to God talking to Eve and the serpent about what's going to happen. You're the one that God is talking about who's going to crush the head of the serpent. You're the one that the prophets spoke of. You're the one that's mentioned all through the writings, all through the Psalms. So many of the Psalms are about him. And so much of the prophetic books are about him. But of course, we know that because Jesus himself says in John 5:39, all the scriptures testify of me, all of them. So Peter's saying all of these things that we've read, if they could read, we don't know that for sure, all of these readings that we've heard in the synagogue every Shabbat for our whole lives, it's all about you. You're the Son of God. And so Peter sees the glory, capital G, despite the flesh that covers it, because he looks like a man. He looks like everyone else. He's veiled in flesh, but Peter sees the glory with this definite confession of faith. No him-hawing, no beating around the bush, no equivocation. And Jesus absolutely, immediately approves what Peter said. This is a clear confession. And he gives Peter a great statement, too, that we always have to keep in mind. He calls him Simon Bar-Jonah. He doesn't call him Rock. Doesn't call him Peter. Doesn't call him Kephas. He goes back to his origins, simple, basic, poor. Bar-Jonah, son of a dove. He wasn't born to dignity, but now, because of the action of God, he realizes that this is the Messiah. Oh, I know the music is playing. Oh, I think we're probably going to have to finish this next week. So thanks for listening and tune in again next week. Have a great week.